Epilogue. A few months later, Johnny heard that the government in Scotland was going to introduce taxation in order to rebuild Edinburgh. He knew that taxation had been unknown in the earliest days of the Scottish nation. The king had just paid for everything way back then. And he doubted Scotland had the resources to do it. Also, he felt a taxation, as a government way of life, was a sort of silly business. Couldn't a government earn its keep? Why did it have to go around robbing people? So he talked to Donald Dean and got him to sell the idea to the chief of Clanfergus that Edinburgh would be rebuilt by contributions. To foster the illusion that the Scottish people were paying for it, he and Donald Dean put little red boxes along trails where Scots could drop in small coins, and they even emptied some of them. But what really happened was that Johnny paid for it. He sent in his Chatoverian construction company, Buildstrong Incorporated. They had finished all the industrial requirements at Luxembourg and banking requirements at Zurich anyway. The Chatoverians, being Chatoverians, sent a research team all around Scotland and the government to find out what people wanted at Edinburgh, and then went on and did what they thought was right regardless. They decided Edinburgh would be in three businesses: planetary government, extraterrestrial training, and Scottish handicraft. It was a real headache to them to reconcile such divergent actions into architecture, which they always maintained must be A, indigenous, and B, suitable for the purpose. The city itself, their research team found, had once been nicknamed Auld Reekie because it smelled so bad. They also found no Scot had lived in it for 1,100 years. This gave them a totally free hand. They rammed down everything except Castle Rock. They got several Highland hydroelectric plants back in operation rapidly, and then called in their companion company, Desperation Defense, and had them make their installations and emplacements. They then put in sewer systems and filtration plants, and then they rubbed their hands and really got to work. They put the northern section of the town into industrial, for business and handicrafts, and gave it the overall look and landscaping of stone cottages, such as the Scots were used to in the Highlands. They sweepingly planned out a large number of specialty schools. Outside, they were all Scotch baronial with the little projecting turrets, castles right out of the old fairy tale books. But the whole of the interiors were adapted to extraterrestrial living. They spread these all over the terrain with big parks. Castle Rock itself they saved for government. It had been so battered and fractured they had to get early engravings of it to see how to shape it. Shaping and armoring rock was no problem to the Chatoverians, but what it had been like a couple thousand years ago was. They got an indication that a castle of an early Scottish king, Duncan, who apparently had been killed by Macbeth, had stood there. Where they got this was a mystery. Somebody said an old play they had found in the wreckage of the British Museum. They reassembled the rock, rebuilt its interior shelters, covered the whole thing with blue Italian marble, got it all armor hard and glowing, and then put Duncan's castle on it in gleaming white. They found a cathedral they liked in an ancient city called Reims that they said agreed with the architecture of the castle, and put it up on the rock in shimmering scarlet and called it St. Giles again. The Scots were enraptured with the result of what they had financed. Johnny thought it looked pretty good too, but it did produce a problem. The Chatoverians, being overpopulated at home, always overhired. And as this job had been rush, and for the boss himself, they had accumulated a very huge crew. They also had a policy that you never fired anybody ever. It left him with a swollen city building team almost the size of Earth's entire population. So he put them to work rebuilding the cities the visitors had burned. This, too, gave the Chatoverians a problem. What were the cities for? Nobody had lived in a city for 1,100 years. So their research teams had to figure out what future use the cities might be put to, based on resources, proximity to rivers and the sea, what crops grew in that climate, who they might someday trade with, how many people would have to be housed for what industry. It was very complex and quite difficult. Establishing the indigenous architecture was easy in Asia, fairly easy in Europe, impossible in America. This last continent had gone madly modern, and the Chataverians couldn't abide it. So they just had to take the most interesting landmark sort of buildings they found on the sites, duplicate those, and make lots and lots of parks. The parent company in Chataveria had overbought Zip monorails on another job, so they shipped those in and internally connected the cities up high so their parks wouldn't be spoiled with roads. They had to get a Hauven company in to clean up the radiation around Denver. They did it with flying magnetic sweeps. Then the Chataverians rebuilt that whole area, including even Johnny's village. There were no populations, so when they would finish a city, they would just seal up the doors and windows, put a caretaker crew in, and leave it. Oh well, Johnny thought, when he saw all these empty cities going up, maybe somebody would live in them someday. Kerr took charge of the mine school in Edinburgh, and the cyclos that were left alive moved there and gave lectures and demonstrations. Absolute hordes of extraterrestrials were pouring in to learn how to mine their own planets and get the metals moving again. Kerr pictographed all the lectures so the technology wouldn't be lost. He used Cornwall and Victoria for practical training, and it kept him pretty busy, tearing around with Chirk, who had the job of building up the libraries. Kerr had a trick of wearing breathe masks with the face of the race he was training painted on it. It made for friendlier relations, he said. There were an awful lot of ex-cyclo planets that had slave populations or people withdrawn to mountains, and the coordinators were very busy running their coordinator college in Edinburgh, showing former subject races how to get organized and prosper. Their enrollment was greatly assisted by the fact that the Galactic Bank gave much more favorable interest rates to such planets when they had coordinators trained in Edinburgh. The New Earth government claimed that Chief of Clan Fergus was king, probably due to the influence of Mr. Tsung's brother. This made Dunnel Dean the crown prince, but from all Johnny could see, neither the chief nor Dunnel Dean took his elevation very seriously. The government was very reluctant to pass laws and generally left things up to tribal chiefs in their own areas, intervening only when there was no other way to end a dispute among them. They were very popular. Colonel Ivan, with the title of the Democratic Valiant Red Army People's Colonel, ruled Russia. Johnny's village people helped him, and then some of the younger ones went back to America to try to get it started again. Chief Chong Wan and the North Chinese tribe made an alliance and began to build up China. Handicraft and silk for export handled their economic needs. They also had a cooking school that became widely attended, for the Salachis spread all over the galaxies, even farther due to their neighborhood banks, swore it was the best cooking anywhere, particularly for fish dishes, and were quick to finance any extraterrestrial who wanted to start a Chinese restaurant in his area, providing he sent some cook trainees to learn how. There were usually more cook trainees in China than Chinese. They not only had to learn to cook, but also had to learn how to grow much of the food. The extra labor and machinery boomed Chinese agriculture and fisheries, and as Chief Chong Wan remarked every time he saw Johnny, which was often, starvation was no longer the main product of the Chinese. Johnny often wondered how an extraterrestrial, who ate quite another diet, could learn to cook food he would never eat. But the power of the bank and the appetites of the Salachis were similarly wonderful. Pursuant to wide galactic conversion to the decimal system, the bank distributed new issues of money. These upset Chrissy considerably. The coins and banknotes looked even less like Johnny. She went on for some days about how they looked even more like a Salachi and even less like Johnny, but Johnny didn't tell her he had carefully maneuvered things in that direction. These days he could walk right down the street and hardly anybody pointed. A couple more issues and no stranger would know him on sight at all. The bank in Snouch never did return their gold. When they built the huge new bank complex there, they put the gold behind armor glass in the main lobby with a multi-language sign on it. This gold was mined personally by Johnny Goodboy Tyler and some Scots. He has left it with us because he trusts us. So can you. If you start your new account today, you can reach through a slot and touch it. When Johnny wanted some gold to plate the inaugural display model of a new teleport car Desperation Defense was now converting to build in Chataveria, Dwight had to go to the Andes with a team of the old crew and open up a mine there to get it. After the surveys on what people wanted were done by the bank, as Johnny suggested, the conversion of X-Arms companies to consumer products went very swiftly. Few of the intergalactic patents were in any demand for a while. They found the people on civilized planets wanted pots and pans and such like, all of which were easily made and quite profitable. The original emissaries were now becoming very wealthy and powerful and backed Johnny's measures to the limit, even guiding their countries towards social democracy